everybody, and welcome to this special review on the Lotus Eaters. I'm Harry, joined today by Connor, and we're going to be talking about the recent smash hit success of the film Obsession and our own thoughts on it, what it means for Hollywood going forward, and some general perceptions on the kind of, like, you would say the cultural momentum that it's generated. It's a kind of pop culture flashpoint with how people have responded to it.
I think it's the perfect horror film for Zoomers, given the nightmarish conditions of relations between the sexes and the total abolition of guardrails in modern dating.
Oh, yeah. Well, the films, we'll get into that as we go on. So just for some context, it is a relatively new horror film directed by a YouTuber, I think, called Curry Barker. Is it Barker or Baker?
Oh, I don't know how to pronounce his surname.
No, Curry. I'll go with Curry Barker. And it was very, very low budget.
$750,000
budget, featuring a lot of actors that you've probably never heard of. I think the biggest named actor in it played a bit role as Nikki's father. And it has been an absolute smash success, kind of runaway, and part of a new era of YouTuber movies that you could say. Because I watched, Markiplier's movie, Iron Lung, earlier on this year. I went to the cinema to watch that. You've got Obsession. I've heard that other film,
Backrooms,
was done by a YouTuber as well.
It was originally a YouTube miniseries, then decided to extrapolate into a full-length feature film that was based on essentially one of the creepypastas. I think it was originally on a 4chan post, where someone took a photo of a partly illuminated abandoned department store and said these are the sort of liminal spaces, the back rooms of the internet, as you were, that you could stumble on and glitch out of reality and see all of mankind's discarded ideas lurking around there, and God forbid you actually go there, because you'll get trapped there. Obsession is less internet focused, but I still think that
Is much less high concept as well.
Yeah, well, but I think internet dating discourse has sort of shaped the themes of the film, because I think there's a superficial reading, and then, as I think, a deeper reading which explains why it has resonated with both sexes, even though it's fairly clear who the villain of the film is.
Yeah, the film makes no bones that you're not supposed to, by the end of the film, like the main character of Bear, which confused me, because I saw at one point his name tag said Baron. This is going to be a spoiler review, by the way. So, like, you know what these conversations are like. They're a little bit freeform. So if we get straight into the spoilers, sorry. You should go watch it, though.
You absolutely should watch the film.
And it's actually genuinely creepy and scary in ways that I wasn't expecting it to be. Some of the scares were very effective, with some very good lighting to pull some of it off.
There was no CGI throughout the entire film, by the way. So The entire film, all of the...
Well, I suppose they couldn't afford it.
Well, quite, yeah. It was done on such a low budget that some people just did some of the things without payment. So there are various moments where Nikki's eyes, after she is possessed by the entity or whatever you're going to call it, are illuminated with orange, so she almost looks like the cat that's passed away
scene. Sandy.
Yeah, and the way that they've done that isn't off the editing. It's just lit that way in the shot, so it looks really well done on shoestrings, but it just shows that when love, care, and attention and genuinely excellent film craft is put into these projects, they still make money, because it's made like $400 million, whereas something like Supergirl has just utterly flopped because there's no audience for it and it looks terrible.
Yeah, that is the important point. It's flopped and looks terrible, because there's just a little bugbear of mine. There's this horrible trend at the moment where all films look very desaturated, and they look as though they are purposefully trying to over-exaggerate and highlight the orange and teal colour scheme, but in a way that is so ugly. Personally, I've never understood the appeal of that colour scheme in the first place, but now that every film is trying to overemphasize it all the time, one, it homogenizes, and two, I think it just makes all of these films look ugly. And you go back and look at a film like, say, 20 years ago, like Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest. That's a film, some of the scenes are darker, some of the scenes are more desaturated, but then you get these beautiful full-color scenes where you're out on the open seas, and it just magnifies the splendor of what you're supposed to be looking at. And I prefer that sort of more older color palette, but that's neither here nor there. Returning to Bear, by the end of the film, Bear's a piece of shit.
Yeah,
like unironically, but also, I think The thing I was going to mention, on his name tag, it says Baron. So I just thought everybody was pronouncing Baron in a really American way for most of the film. Because I just thought they were going, Baron, or something like that.
Well, I think his nickname is a play on the discourse last year that was very performative of women choosing between the man or the bear in the woods, because they were going to bet that actually they were safer with the bear because the man could rape them. And this is the reading.
Because a bear could never do anything as bad as that.
Oh yeah, you've never seen The Revenant. So the reading of the film that is sort of surface level is the reason this is really horrific is because the horror is a kind of body horror in that you're possessed by an entity that robs you of your agency, and it forces Nikki to be in a relationship with Bear against her will while she's conscious but kind of trapped inside her own mind, almost like hammering on the glass of her eyes.
She can feel everything that's going on with her body the whole time.
Yeah, exactly. But I think the subtext of the film, which is where it's resonated with both men and women, and it still keeps Bear as the villain, but it also doesn't cast any of his friends in a good light, is that Obsession is a horror film for women because they dread waking up one day and finding themselves trapped in a relationship that they're with a man that they're repulsed by, and they feel that they've wasted their life and that in some way their agency has been confiscated. And Obsession is also a horror film for men. It's a cautionary tale to say, if you lack the sufficient courage to engage in dating honestly, especially in an environment where all the courtship rituals and all of the elder supervision in your best interest is broken down, then you will end up getting love bombed by a crazy woman who bypasses your threat detection in your need to want to be in a relationship with her, to be loved and adored. And eventually, because you haven't properly vetted her, she'll start like screaming at you in public and causing a scene, breaking down hysterically about things that you don't understand, and your life will be a living hell. And so Obsession is basically the hell that both men and women have found themselves in when they're incapable of being honest, and when dating itself is not done for their long-term interest. There's no courtship rituals. You're not seeking a husband or a wife and a father and mother of your children, but instead you're doing it for your own hedonistic gratification, as all the characters do all sorts of other things throughout the film.
Yes. It is kind of the warning of don't date a BPD girl.
Yeah, she's a characteristic BPD
girl. She might be fun for that one night, but beyond that, you are going to be in a living hell.
Yeah, well, she has all the markers, so she this is possessed Nikki. She fabricates a backstory to engender sympathy with Bear. So, oh, my dad has cancer, so I need to stay at your place tonight. She initially mirrors his behavior by saying, oh, my cat died, and then correcting herself. She's incredibly emotionally volatile. She has an anxious avoidant attachment style. So there's a scene where she's crying hysterically in the corner of the room over whether or not Bear loves her as much as she has been compelled by the One Wish Willow to love him.
That's a really well done scene as well.
That
was like, before then in the film, I'd been cringing because of how relatable and realistic the social relationships had been, and some of the social interactions they'd been having. I was like, oh, I've been there. Oh, I've seen that happen. And I was cringing, but I was like, there's an ominous tension building up, but I'm not scared yet. And then that scene hits, and it's that question of, is she about to try and claw his eyes out? And anything where you've got a silhouetted dark figure standing off-center in the corner of the screen, in the corner of the room, making noises and you can't properly detect her, can be really effective. It's not as effectively done in something like, for instance, it's kind of an improvement on what was done in Hereditary, if you ever saw that. There's a scene near the end of that film where one of the characters who becomes possessed is away just out of view in the dark in the corner of a room. And the initial visual is creepy, but then when you see her move, it's so obviously fake that it comes across as comical. Now, Nikki moves in a lot of very unnerving and unnatural and obviously fake ways through the film, but the filmmaking manages to pull it off in such a way that it is actually unnerving because it comes across so unnatural, it feels like she's going to jump at you through the screen.
Yep.
There's, in particular, I'm thinking of the reverse walking scenes,
yep,
which came so out of left field that it got a jump out of me, even though it's not a traditional jump scare.
One of the most terrifying bits is after she goes from the corner, and then she comes to his bedside. She's got the flowers over her face. She snaps back to normality, which is, again, the classic BPT trait. Oh, yeah. Sort of emotional whiplash, and also threats of violence if they feel abandoned, or if they feel that this partner they've put on a pedestal to reassure their unstable sense of identity is slipping away from them, or isn't fulfilling all of their expectations. Because obviously, you know, before that reverse walking scene, she threatens to sort of cut her wrists if he doesn't stay with her. The most unsettling thing for me was when she gets into bed with him and she falls asleep, and he thinks of like lifting her arm and creeping out, and when she goes stay.
Oh yeah.
And part of the reason is, I think, it's really unnerving to see a woman behave essentially like a toddler. Mm. And all of her behavior was monotonous, unsettling. She has this babyish voice. She essentially throws temper tantrums.
She throws really cutesy facial expressions about and sort of like manipulates her face in a way that I see with my toddler.
Yeah.
When she wants to get what she wants.
And I think this is the situation that men will find themselves in when they want a woman to be dependent on them to ensure that their fear of rejection never comes to pass. But actually what ends up happening is you get someone that is very dependent on you and is incapable of regulating their own emotions and even their own bodily functions. When she stands in one spot and sort of defecates herself, yeah, and vomits, and she ends up responding saying like, I swallowed a fly, which is something either a kid or a pet would say. So he essentially wants either
so you're going with the Sandy theory a little bit.
Well, I'm not saying that she is. There is a theory that the spirit that Nikki is possessed by is the cat. But I certainly think there are parallels drawn to a pet's behavior. I don't think it's, yes, literally that it's been possessed. But what ends up happening is if you are too cowardly to risk rejection and you are dishonest by going into a relationship, you'll get someone who is so dependent on you that they're not acting like an adult, and you will have to make up for the deficit of their own lack of independence or lack of functioning. And essentially your own life will unravel. And that's why her behavior is so unsettling, because it's like watching a grown woman behave like a dependent child. And then when you're meant to be in a romantic relationship with essentially someone who's behaving like a child, it's really, really unnerving.
Yeah, I would say as well as everything that we're talking about with the relationship stuff, it's not just the personal romantic relationship that felt very real to me in this film, and that I think the film is trying to address and talk about, because the broader friendship group that Nikki and Bear exist within is also, and I hate to use modern online language for this, but it is the appropriate word to use, incredibly toxic.
I was about to use the exact
same
phrase.
It's an incredibly toxic friendship group of the kind that I have been familiar with when I was younger and associated with these types of people. It's a very, very small scale film, by the way, folks. There's only like 4 or 5 sets, only really 4 main characters in the entire plot, and everybody else in the film is just kind of an extra. And these 4 main characters are the focal point of every major story beat and every interaction that we see through the film.
It's Bear, Sarah, Ian, and Nikki.
And frankly, even before the supernatural shit starts to happen, they are all awful.
Yeah.
So, but it tricks you a little bit with Bear, because he is shown as being more sympathetic at the beginning. And I can see myself in his... I've never been in his position, but I could see myself sympathizing if I had been in his position. But at the same time, as you say, he's also a coward. He's presented multiple opportunities at the beginning of the film to simply be honest about how he feels. But also, again, there are interpersonal friend dynamics going on which kind of are trying to stop him. You have Nikki, who you find out by the end of the film is having sex on again, off again with his best friend Ian, and is basically knows that she can tell that Bear likes her, and she doesn't want to break it to him because she leans on him for emotional support.
She deliberately keeps him in the friend zone. She is, as Patrice O'Neill once described, using him as a time hoe. Essentially, yeah, you can build my shelf, ho, you can drive me home, ho, you can kill this spider, ho, but it will never be reciprocated in the way that Bear has fantasized about. And when you...
The darkest thing with that, I've seen that happen to somebody recently. One of my fiancé's friends was doing that to somebody, and when my fiancé called her out on it and said, why are you leading this guy along? She went, oh, I'm not leading him along.
Women always know. Like, Nikki knows, so that's why she sussed out that Bear had been tricked into essentially negging her by Ian in the car, and that's why when she asked, do you like me, and Bear failed that test of courage, she knew that he wasn't being honest. And she had always known that he wasn't being honest, because otherwise she wouldn't have been hanging around him and felt so uncomfortable when he bought her a gift, or when Ian said, take your girl home. Like, she knew that Bear had these unrequited feelings for her, and she was using it to extract emotional validation, to emotionally dump any time that her writing gig didn't work out or she was going through a life change. And at the same time, she was crowdsourcing self-esteem using social media, because the only time social media is actually featured in this film, and I think it might be a strange thing to say, but I think it's fairly odd that social media isn't more prominent and porn is non-existent, given Bear is basically celibate and idealizing Nikki. But he uses her social media to self-soothe, and she's got thousands of likes and comments on random selfies that she's been putting up. And she is an unremarkable girl working in a music store in some unremarkable area of America. And so the idea is that she is, even though as much as she says, oh, I need to know love in order to write this novel, which ends up being an incestuous retelling of Hansel and Gretel, even though she's saying that...
Well, that's Freaky Nikki's version of it.
Well, no, she's just reading out the passages from Nikki's book earlier. Because do you remember when Bear says, oh, it's a romance. Is it a romance? When she says it's a love story, and she goes, they're not the same thing. So that exactly, that was the plan beforehand.
Oh, no, she's writing slash fiction for women's shelves. Oh, he's going to turn out to be an 8-foot-tall bull man.
But she's, as much as she says, oh, I need to know love to write this story, nothing she's doing in her life actually will allow her to receive love. None of her relationships are reciprocal. It's shown by the fact that when she gives the money to the homeless black guy, right, it's not her money. She asks for her friend's money to give away.
Which is funny, because it shows that those sort of, those character traits of hers that Bear idealizes at the beginning of the film when he's explaining to Ian why he likes her so much are also false, because he idealizes a time, she's so generous, remember how she gives money to hobos? And it's like, no, she gives other people's money to homeless people so she can feel good about it when she's just stealing money, really.
And as well, Ian, that you mentioned earlier, she might be in a long-term situationship with Ian, which is just another sort of horrible quirk of Zoomer dating. But Ian purposefully sabotages him from the first scene of the movie, where you think that Bear is, you know, being earnest and trying to put himself out there, which is why I think a lot of people have sympathized with Bear online. Discourse around the film has been quite factional as to whether or not you side with Bear or you side with Nikki, when actually both of them are flawed in their own ways.
Yeah, it's like the worst girl that you know sympathizes with Nikki, and like a guy that you're kind of suspicious of sympathizes way too much with Bear by the end. Like some people I've seen where it's like, when you think about it, Bear's the victim. It's like,
he's generated this entire situation for himself because he is a coward.
He hears Nikki's soul screaming in hell and chooses to do nothing about it.
Yeah, he has sex with her after he knows that she lied about her father. So he willfully participates in the lie because he wants to delude himself. But the thing I was going to mention is the one time that Bear has the opportunity to be honest is when he's practicing that speech with the diner waitress. And then Ian mocks him for it. Mm-hmm. Says, don't be open about your feelings. You've got all the time in the world. Knowing Nikki was going to leave the job because he's been hooking up with her and knows much more about her than Bear does. And he's also been having sex with her behind his friend's back. And then
when he knows that his friend fancies her more than anybody else in the world.
Yeah, and then to complete the sort of bingo card of being a piece of shit, when Bear goes to him and says, look, man, you know Nikki's been acting crazy. You've not wanted her at the party. You've been warning me off her. It's because of this magical toy called the One Wish Willow from the 80s. I didn't think it worked. When I snapped it, it broke. This explains everything. And Ian's like, okay, well, I don't really believe you, but in case I did, I want $1 billion. And it just starts raining money from the sky.
That was a hilarious scene.
Yeah. It was really well done.
It was, it's a really well done bit, because the film is really creepy and suspenseful, and there's loads of tension and creepy imagery and scenes. There are some really funny parts as well.
The frowning Nikki face that has been memed to death is hilarious.
Yeah, that's great. But the look on Ian's face when the money starts raining and it's real and he's like, oh shit, because you can tell he's like, oh shit, I just fucked over my best friend, but also I'm a billionaire. And the money starts raining and the music changes and you get this almost glorious triumphant sting in the background, because I think at that point the film is kind of, one, enjoying the absurdity of the situation, two, kind of reveling that Bear has fucked himself over so thoroughly by that point. I will say my only gripe with the film is immediately in the next scene, after knowing that it's real, Ian, for some reason, follows Bear back to his apartment so he can knock on the door and be like, Bear, it's real. It's real. I'm a billionaire now, bro. And step into the flat just so he can be shot by Nikki. Not saying he didn't deserve it by that point.
But frankly, it's a little bit of a contrivance.
But it was a major contrivance. It felt like either they were going just for the shock, or it might have just been a holdover from a different version of the script where perhaps Bear hadn't been there for Ian's revelation.
If you would like to see the full version of this premium video, please head over to lotuseaters.com and subscribe to gain full access to all of our premium content.